trouble. She was careful with her footing. Glinting liquor bottle glass crunched under the tread of her heavy work shoes. Rotting boards that had been used to seal the doors and windows of the stripped and vandalized building were lying in the grass, as they had been for the last year. Vacant units were supposed to be sealed to protect them from thieves and to keep children out. But as soon as the boards went up, they came down. Salt had often used this place to watch the drug transactions across the street at the corner walk-up food shop. Careful to avoid the condoms and human feces that littered the concrete floor, she stepped from the doorway to the broken window facing the street. Lifting the binoculars, she focused, bringing the players, surrounded by a yellow haze from the streetlights on the corner, into view. Man-Man and Johnny C., light-skinned brothers, handsome in red jerseys. Heavy-set Booty Green, skinny and quick Lil D., and half-dead, and Q-Ball with his shiny head. All the usual gang members, except Stone, were running the trap tonight. She scanned the shadows, hoping to locate Stone leaning against some corner or sitting in a car. He'd get her vote for most dangerous. Sometimes he'd walk up close to her on calls, staring and crossing the line into a scene. He gave her hard looks, constantly challenging with an unspoken threat, and had recently pointed his finger at her and mimed pulling the trigger. Searching and not finding him in the lens of the binoculars, she became aware of a breeze on the back of her neck. Propped on the sill of the window, viewing the action left her back exposed to the doorless entry. She counted on the bits of glass on the floor to serve as warning. Her ears were on hyper alert. Lil D moved into focus. He was wearing fresh new clothes. Maybe he'd moved up in the gang. Mainly, he'd just held and done hand-to-hands, usually in the same baggy jeans, shorts, orange jersey, and worn sneakers. He was wearing shiny black and red shorts, a matching jersey, number 38, police code for drugs, and new sneakers, $200 red flashers, presenting him as an equal, mid-level in the drug gang chain. Salt sat back, waited, watching. 9 years ago, Lil D had been living with his grandmother, his father's mother, Mrs. Mobley, in the Holmes, the largest part of Salt's then new beat. She had gotten a domestic disturbance to Mrs. Mobley's apartment, and when she got there, Lil D was bad-mouthing his grandmother, whose apartment was a known shot house, where illegal booze by the glass and loose cigarettes were sold. Card games and gambling were other sidelines, and the two-bedroom apartment was almost always a chaotic place filled with people trying to numb some kind of misery. That call wasn't the first Salt had gotten involving Lil D fighting with Mrs. Mobley. For several weeks, radio had kept sending her to respond to either the grandmother or Lil D, or someone calling 911 about their back-and-forths. But that day was different. Lil D, there on the stoop, with a towel around his neck, tired and scared, wasn't a hard case yet. He seemed to Salt to hold a recognizable hope for some adult to give him a childhood. That day, struggling to swallow, trying to be angry so he wouldn't cry, afraid to trust one more person. She took his despair hard. She had needed to believe a kid from the Holmes could make it, could have a real childhood. So she jumped at the first idea that came to her. To buy the time she thought she'd need to get him help or to find a program, Lil D would have to go to juvenile lockup. She explained that he would have to be arrested, that a placement could be found for him from juvenile. As they talked, he began to look more at her and less toward the apartment, away from his grandmother's and the pressure to work the avenue, and toward the possibility of escape by arrest.
I got to get locked up so I can get what?
I'm going to make some calls, get you in a program, a group home, maybe good foster care, Get some recommendations to the judge.
He looked back at his grandmother's, then shrugged. Anything would be better than trying to stay here. Looks like I got no choice.
Come on, I'll charge you with a hummy, a bullshit charge, Salt had told him. Call me a bitch.
What?
Call me a bitch.
You want me to call you a bitch?
You have to, so I can take you to juvenile. You have to commit a crime. Call me a bitch.
Bitch, he said flatly, then sniffed and wiped his nose.
The next day, Reverend Bradford's voice dripped with world-weary heaviness, delivering a no-room-at-the-inn speech that sounded rote. It was the same with all the other contacts and agencies Salt called. Any program had a wait of at least 30 days. Refusing to give up, Salt went back to juvenile on her lunch minutes, between calls, hoping they would hold Lil D until a spot opened up, only to find that an anonymous caseworker had disregarded her request to contact her before releasing him. Big D had been allowed to get his son and take him back to the homes, his grandmother's liquor house, and this street. It wasn't like she'd given up. She kept asking, kept knocking on the doors of the system. Lil D and his family were bound, brick and bone, mortar and marrow, with and by the homes. Every encounter with Lil D since, he'd look away, move away, or spit on the street and put on a street face. Lil D and Salt, 9 years. Through the jumpy, jittery binocular view she focused on him, all these hard years later, now selling on the avenue full time. It was difficult to hold a steady image with the powerful binoculars. Any slight movement on her part caused ghosts to run through the focus and people to jiggle around unnaturally. His features in a blur, Lil D could have been his mother. He'd never grown much taller than the 5'5" he had been as a 14-year-old, still rail thin, but the scared kid was locked beneath the hard lines of his face. He cocked his chin defiantly, his eyes hooded, his mouth puckered in a permanent scowl, the steady and street-tough anger. The birthmark was barely visible in the shifting focus. He leaned against the dingy white bricks of Sam's chicken shack, with one foot propped behind him. A dark blue sedan pulled into the parking lot and stopped near Booty Green, tonight's deal man, who gave a nod to Lil D. Lil D pumped himself off the wall, going to get the product from behind the food joint. Nearby, a decked-out yellow low-rider truck shimmied with bass beats as Lil D sauntered around the building. He was at the backside of the building for about 20 seconds and returned with a cool walk, arms dangling, fingers loose, except the thumb of his right hand was tucked into his palm. He went over to Green. Arms touching, they leaned together into the open window of the dark sedan. Green and Lil D backed away and returned to their positions, the thunk-thunk of the lowrider vibrating the prismed light of the corner, the blue sedan rolling out of the lot. The ghetto girls gang, with their neon red and blonde hairdos, shook into the scene, pretending to ignore the come-on calls of the corner boys. Salt heard glass crunch. She slid from the window to avoid backlighting from the street. Weighing the risk, she turned off her two-way so that the radio traffic wouldn't give her away. She waited in a squat. Two figures stumbled into the door. The couple didn't see her as they went past into the next room, probably searching for a mattress and a safe place to share a pipe. Salt breathed and quickly stepped out of the apartment, back onto the path, and back up the hill toward her car, 30 or so yards away. Illuminated by the streetlight, Stone sat on the hood of her black and white, his bony shoulders curved in toward the cigar he was lighting. His profile was instantly recognizable. In addition to the wing-like shoulders, his head was very round and too small for his build. Sitting on her car was an arrogant street insult. Salt switched the radio back on. 3306 to radio. Can any unit meet me at Mowry and Thurkill? Stone knew the rules. It was challenging her again, both of them knowing how long it would likely take for another cop to get there. Stone's white t-shirt was loose, plenty of room to conceal. Salt continued up the hill, knowing that to stop or back off would concede Stone ownership of territory. It felt like a cliched confrontation from a movie, but she could not afford concessions. Careful of the language of the street, the moves, she didn't draw any weapon, but surreptitiously unsnapped gas and gun. There were no private moments in these streets. Someone always passed the word. Someone could always testify. "Get off the car," she said, moving in, giving him fair notice. Stone pretended to be listening to the loud rap from the corner, kicking his leg to the beat, keeping time and mouthing the words, "Fuck the police, fuck the police." His cheekbones shone in the light, making it hard to tell whether his eyes were open or closed. "Off the car," she repeated at the curb. She came around the trunk. He lifted his chin, ignoring her, looking away down the street. He's caught in his own game, she thought. He propped himself, stiff-armed, leaning on his hands. Her hands were free. There were gunshots in the distance. He pushed off, slid his bone and muscled body from the hood. She touched leather. He brought his left hand up. His right touched the hem of his t-shirt. He pointed his left barrel finger, keeping it trained on her, while he slipped past the streetlight circle into the shadows of the building. Stone must have passed the word, because the boys on the corner were ignoring both the walk-up customers and the cars pulling into the lot looking to score. She stopped her cruiser in the Chicken Place parking lot, close to where Lil D was standing. He watched her arrival, then turned his face, and as he often did in front of his boys, spit on the pavement. Salt got out and stood there until she was sure everybody on the corner had noticed and was paying some kind of attention. So many people out on this warm summer night, a kind of insurance. There was plenty of light from the food shop and the streetlights. Mr. George, sitting on the curb nearby, nodded slightly. She had delivered his grandchild when his daughter went into premature labor last year. Sitting on the curb beside him was Crazy Sue, who counted on Salt to get her to the city hospital when her medication ran out or just didn't work anymore. There were enough people here, maybe not to stop a bullet, but to at least drop a dime, to bear witness that she was doing her job, occasionally interrupting the dope traffic for a minute, messing with the gang. She walked, still cautious, to the back of the building, where from her vantage point across the street she had seen Lil D go to get the single rocks for the buyers. She stood behind the dirty cinderblock building for a few seconds, kicked at food bags and takeout boxes, knowing that there were too many places to conceal dope for her to find the stash. After a few more seconds, enough for a show, at random, she picked up a paper sack and walked to the front of the store. The rest of the gang was drifting off, but the stash was Lil D's responsibility tonight, and he couldn't leave it, or the geekheads would steal it before he got back. Lil D, of course, would know what kind of container the crack was concealed in, so he wasn't particularly worried when Salt came back around, holding the brown bag. But the fact that she had some kind of bag caused him to grow watchful and less casual. He dropped his foot from the wall and fell away from his leaning spot, less cool, now not trying to ignore her. Salt, running the routine, radioed Pepper, 3306 to 3307, come on in. The pressure was working on Lil D, but it was too late for him to leave cool. His timing was off, and he had to protect the dope. Pepper pulled up and was quickly out of his car, moving toward Lil D. They hemmed him in between the building, their cars, and themselves. Lil D said, "You got nothing in that bag, lest you took it back there with you." Salt responded, "But you don't know, do you, Lil D?" Pepper, "Get your hands on the car." Lil D appealed to Salt. "You always been straight. Now you planting dope on folks? What's up with you?" She stepped toward him. "Put your hands on the car." Outmaneuvered, Lil D assumed the position, hands on top of the cruiser, legs spread. She patted him down, ignoring what felt like a small bag of weed in his right pants pocket. She leaned close and told him quietly, "A little bit there, huh, Lil D?"
"You ain't got no charge to take me. You can't do this, man."
Lil D knew the rules of probable cause as well as any defense attorney. He had been arrested and through the system many times for minor stuff, but he had never done more than a few months.
"Get in the car," Salt said, opening the back door of the cruiser.
Pepper stepped closer, his 6-foot-plus frame diminishing the slight dope boy.
"Man,"
said Lil D, getting in the car. Salt shut the door, and Lil D leaned his forehead against the back seat cage. As they moved out of his hearing, Pepper asked, "You want me to hang around?"
"No, I'm just going to talk to him. Ask some questions about how he got all those fresh clothes, but he knows about who Chanel was hanging with before she was killed. Then I'll turn him loose."
"Homicide's working Chanel. They don't need you messing around in that."
"It's my beat. I don't like folks getting murdered on my beat."
"You keep messing with these dope boys, they're gonna make things even more rough for you out here."
"It's my beat.
I'll raise you after I let him go," Salt said, turning to get in her car. With Lil D protesting, Salt left the parking lot, drove a couple of blocks, and turned into the drive of the elementary school that served the homes. Spacious frontage and playgrounds put acres between the school and the apartments. Around back was dark except for one dim bulb above a steel-bolted door. Lil D asked, "What we doing here?" Salt stopped the car, put it in park, turned around, and faced Lil D through the metal screen.
"I could have stood around at Sam's trying to ask you about your mom's murder. Would you have talked to me in front of your boys? Could have asked you about your new clothes. Would you have talked to me? This way, they don't see you talking to me."
"I ain't got shit to say to you anyway. I ain't got to answer. Ain't no crime to have new clothes."
Lil D's face in the low light was shadowed through the latticework steel. He avoided looking at her, and instead kept his head turned toward the dark side of the car.
"You're right. But it is a crime what you do to get those clothes. And even if you don't believe me, I do want to find out who killed Chanel. Your mother probably died because of dope, yet you're out here slinging."
"I ain't talking to you about my business, and you can go ask Big D about who killed my mom," he said, gritting his teeth, breathing heavy, and for once looking at her.
"And how do I find Big D?"
"I don't give a shit. You the police."
The minutes clicked by, and the car air conditioner began to fail, putting out a powdery odor. Sometimes she thought of her police car like a church or a confessional. Lil D said,
"Let me out or take me to jail."
Radio was dispatching and asking for units to clear for backed-up calls. She couldn't keep sitting there, hoping that Lil D wasn't too far gone.
How long? She wondered.
She could just add Mother's Day to a mental calendar on which the holidays were blighted. Malnourished children at Thanksgiving. Mothers robbed of their children's toys at Christmas. A grandmother raped coming home from Easter services. A calendar of grief, starting with January, the worst. How long? 5 years ago in the homes, working New Year's Day. First call out of the precinct. Baby, dead, 2 months old. Another broken child. Salt wouldn't remember his name. Would not. Left in the apartment with some guy who paid for a room.
The witness who testified that he told the mother he wasn't going to watch after no baby while she was out getting high. Mother had come home, geeked up and drunk, had passed out on top of her baby, found him suffocated underneath when the hangover awoke her New Year's Day. In Salt's custody, the mother cried, not over the baby, but for her broken bottle of gin. How long? For months after, she would sit in her car or in some fast food place between calls, trying to hide the silent tears running down her cheeks. One day, Pepper said, "You have got to be able to close the door on these calls once they're over. You have got to shut the door, or you'll never be able to stay doing this job. We bleed enough for our own. I refuse to bleed for all the rest of these people out here." "How long?" she said out loud. "How long the fuck what?" Lil D kicked at the steel partition. Now she tried to close doors. Sometimes it worked. Here, with Lil D, she didn't know what was possible, couldn't decide if the hope was more for him or herself, and if hope should depend on one person. She had invoked a prayer, and Chanel, his mother, had walked out through the darkness, and she'd taken her to jail for stabbing Big D, and now she was dead.
"Let me out or take me to jail. What you just sitting here for? It's my mama was killed. Now you jamming me up."
She got out, slammed the door, and threw open the back door. "You're jamming yourself up, Lil D. You want to stay out here until you get put in jail or killed? Have at it."
"You trying to help me now?"
Lil D stood and started to walk away. When he was about 5 yards out, she heard him say, like he was reminding her of 9 years ago, "Bitch!" He kept walking, not knowing she'd never needed a reminder. "Say it again, Lil D," she called out.
"Bitch."
His voice barely heard, soft even, as he started in the opposite direction from Sam's. Chapter 9. The Gang. Billy's knobby head bobbed above the semicircle of cops that surrounded him. As Salt got out of the cruiser, she could hear how angry his words sounded.
"King Silver of mine!" he shouted.
It was hard for people, his family, cops, to understand the fear that drove Billy's rage.
"You ain't my own!"
Billy's bare, long arm swept the air above him as he roared. She walked up behind almost half the officers on the shift. "I'm here, Sarge. I heard the call come up, but I was on a kitty call and had to make the run to detention. You ready for me to talk to him?" The afternoon sun, at its hottest, burned through their dark uniforms. Sarge tugged at his sweat-soaked shirt and eyed the teenagers joining other Holmes residents gathered to watch the Billy show.
"It worries me that you and this crazy fucker understand each other, but he's under arrest and we need you to get him in the wagon. We might as well write an SOP to raise you when a Billy call comes up."
He turned sideways to let her pass through the line. Billy Wallace picked up one of his huge feet and stomped.
"You take my fish and eat them, too!"
He turned toward the apartment he was standing in front of, turned back, lifted his leg, and stomped another threat toward the cops. Tributaries of sweat ran from Billy's face, merging in long streams on his completely naked body. As soon as Billy noticed her, he shook his fist.
"You!" he shouted. "You heard me calling you! Didn't they tell you, King Silver?"
At 6'7" and weighing over 250, Billy towered over Salt by nearly a foot and outweighed her by at least 100 pounds. He was more or less psychotic, depending on whether he had taken his meds or smoked crack or both. He had an ongoing paranoia about his family and was known to fight cops. 6 months ago, Billy had broken two of Sarge's ribs. "I came as soon as I could." She never lied to Billy. He'd be sure to remember the next time, and there was always a next time. Billy turned his back to her then, wide-eyed, jerked his head over his shoulder. He began to run in place as if warming up. Salt heard the clicks of metal batons behind her. "What happened today, Billy?" He made a rope-pulling motion with his arms.
I called you, King Silver. They ain't my own.
I'm here now. She took a step toward him. He lowered his arms, but kept his fists clenched.
I did the best I could, she said.
Billy sat down on the steps of the apartment's entrance.
King Silver.
His voice went down, some of the rage dissipating. The children sang,
We see you thang, Billy. We see you thang.
Billy's genitals swung between his bent knees. His chest rose and fell with rapid breathing. As she walked closer, he took in a long, slow breath, even while his eyes jerked over the other cops, the children, and a few others in the crowd. Salt said,
What's going on?
She took a step closer.
I want all them, King Silver,
motioning at the other cops,
to leave.
They can't leave, Billy. Salt moved forward another step. How about a cigarette? She asked, keeping her eyes on his arm and leg muscles, watching for any increased tension, watching his eyes, his breathing. Billy let his arms loosen and said,
I want a fishy, orange Fanta.
We'll get it for you.
Salt nodded to Sarge, who motioned a rookie to go get the drink. Salt shook out two cigarettes from the pack she kept in her pocket. She lit them and offered one to Billy. As he took the cigarette, she nodded.
Before you get in the wagon, your drink will be here by then.
I don't want to go in the fishy wagon.
He didn't say he wasn't going.
You know when all this fuss happens, you have to go. But you can have another cigarette and your drink.
She carried cigarettes for the street, mostly. The urge to cough rose when the smoke reached the bottom of her throat. Billy inhaled, then lowered his head. Still careful, Salt sat down on the step about 3 feet from the big man. They sat there, smoking, the other cops and Sarge watching and beginning to relax, edging out of the circle toward any available shade. The rookie got back with the drink, and Salt went over, got the can, and came back to Billy.
I'll walk you to the wagon.
He stood up, jerking one side of his face forward, giving the other cops the evil eye, his movements and matching eye threats parodying a bad guy. Just because he was crazy didn't mean he'd lost his sense of humor. She walked with him to the paddy wagon, opened the rear doors, and when he was seated inside, waited until he gulped his orange drink.
I'll see you in a few days, Billy. I'll come by.
She gently shut the cage door. The rest of the cops and a small crowd drawn to the drama, mostly folks from the 1400 building where Billy had been cornered, began to drift away. Salt sat in the air-conditioned car, catching up on paperwork. She looked up from the report forms and saw Man-Man standing not 5 feet away. He began to applaud as she lowered the window.
You good. You good, Salt,
he said, smiling and walking toward her car. He wore his usual, always new long white T-shirt, spotless baggy jean shorts, gang garb, but simple, never any flash. Hairline precise. His hair was cut so close it was hard to tell the color. He was average height and build, 5'9", and muscular without showiness. But he also had something that the girls loved, and in the projects, he was considered the epitome of sexy. He had just slightly bowed legs, which gave him a natural swagger as he walked.
Hey, man, Salt said.
He stepped back, making room for her to open the car door. Smiling, she got out of her cruiser, eager to grab this opportunity to find out what Man knew about Chanel. Anyway, she was always happy to see him when they met like this, on neutral ground. He was charming, with his beautiful, wide smile and tight, light skin. He and his brother, Johnny C., were the top dogs of the homes. They controlled the crack market. And lately, there were rumors about guns. She'd just heard the word gun here and there, just pieces. Man and his brother were successful because of two things. They were loved, and they were feared. Salt liked them both on a personal level. Man especially was always friendly during their non-combat interactions. The two of them had an ongoing discussion about life in the projects. He had been born 25 years ago in the Holmes. He had a sharp sense of cause and effect, and knew bullshit when he heard it. Man had only finished 7th grade, being truant most of the 8th and 9th, until he completely stopped going to school by 10th grade. By then, he was organizing the crack sales. Salt understood that if it came down to it, Man would kill to keep what he had built in the Holmes. He was the leader of the gang. But these realities didn't keep either of them from enjoying their occasional conversations.
"Why do you care about Billy Wallace? Don't nobody in the rest of this city care about him,"
Man said, lazy-like, his way of leading into a discussion. "Do you care about Billy?" Salt said agreeably.
"Billy chews to use.
If it wasn't here, he'd have a hard time using." Man came back with,
"He'd just use something else to smooth out his head."
"You may be right about that. Or maybe he'd be so desperate he would get real help."
"Yeah,"
Man said.
"And where that help coming from?"
Salt didn't have an answer, and instead turned the conversation toward Chanel. "You talked to the homicide detective yet?" Just then, about a half block up, Stone, his distinctive shoulders hunched, walked across the street in front of them. He turned his head in their direction. Man lifted his chin, acknowledging his lieutenant. Stone kept his face toward them, even as he continued to wherever he was going. He didn't return Man's gesture. "What's up with him?" she asked. Man answered,
"You know Stone B. Stone."
He shrugged, watching until Stone was out of sight. Man looked back to her, at her scalp, eyes narrowing.
"I see you got a new hairdo."
He tapped his own close-cut scalp in the same place as her scar. "You changed the subject, dude. How's Lil D doing?" she asked.
"Lil D all right. He calmed down."
"You normally keep things cool around here, but you got a lot going on. Lil D's not happy? Stone a wild card?" She was fishing. "Chanel's murder? You know murders tend to bring heat." Man's pleasant face changed. His eyes narrowed, and he gave her a hard look as he said,
"You ain't no detective. What do you care about, no ho?"
She flashed on Chanel's dead, bowed head. "She was more than a whore. She was one of your boy's mother. Lil D isn't going to forget." Salt stopped, realizing her voice was sounding strained. Man's face got harder.
"Chanel wasn't much of a mama," he said.
"Yeah, but she was his mama, and this is my beat, man. The way I see it, doesn't much happen around here that you don't have some way to find out about. I just thought you might be willing to help me on this," she said, trying to lighten her tone, while wondering suddenly if she hadn't just given Man too much. Now he might figure out that Chanel meant something to her.
"You got your job, and I got mine," he said.
Salt came back to the issue they almost always ended their encounters discussing. "Man, you could do anything you want to, yet you choose to run the gang. You're smart, you look good, and you know how to get along. Why not try something else? Go back to school."
"Why you a cop? It's what you know. I know the street. Rich people do what they know. They get their share. I'm just getting my share."
"Yeah, your share comes off people like Billy and Chanel." She ground the heel of her boot in the hot dust. Man pushed off her car, turned, and started walking off. She called after him. "I guess that means you either don't know, don't want to know, or won't help me about Chanel. He threw back an end-of-discussion wave as he turned the corner of the 1400 building. Like any effective CEO, Mann knew about all significant events in and around the homes. Marcy Street was only a few blocks out of the actual projects. Every addict in the area was hooked into Mann and his gang. And although his gang was small, his network, considering the number of people who used his product, was huge. The actual gang members included his brother, their cousin Booty Green, Q-Ball, and Half Dead, all of whom had grown up with them in the homes, and of course Lil D and Stone. The structure of the gang was simple. Mann and Johnny C made the deals for the product in bulk or weight. They arranged for it to be cut, packaged, and sold. Booty, Q, Half Dead, and Lil D were the street-level dealers. Though most people in the projects were cautious around any of the gang members, they knew you could talk to Mann and his brother. Stone was the one they avoided. He was unpredictable, volatile, and seemed to get off on hurting people. So Mann and Johnny C used the threat of him to keep other dope heavies out of the homes, and used him to make sure debts were paid. He was feared by everyone but Mann. Salt wondered as she sat in her car what that told her about Mann, and how good a hold he had on Stone. Her head was starting to throb. Light grew around the edges of her vision. In her mind's eye, Chanel's face, shiny with sweat, the shadows of the patrol car screen crisscrossing her dark skin, came into sharp focus. Mann would have to be pushed. Salt had friends, narcotics, vice, and the gang unit. Mann, so big on claiming his share. She saw his point. But what share or justice was there for Billy, for Chanel? Pepper pulled up.
Why are you just sitting here? Calls are backing up.
I just got through talking to Mann, she answered.
I worry about you, Pepper said. You're closer to people here than outside the job.
Come on, Pep.
I keep telling you, you gotta let Anne fix you up. You clean up pretty good.
He reared back with that smile.
I'm not gonna get into all that girlfriend talk, but as I remember, your last date was what, 5 years ago?
He bugged his eyes out at her. Salt shook her head and said, McKinsey was a jerk. I tried.
That was one guy.
I might clean up on the outside, but I'm more at home here than in some club on the north side. I'm no good at small talk. I end up frozen, trying to keep from saying something that sounds freaky. Cop talk or Holmes talk.
People like to hear police stories. Sex and violence, you know.
I don't like trotting out some misery from Tales of the Holmes for entertainment. Salt shook her head. It feels sleazy.
Pepper turned his face to hers.
Unless there's a point to the story, something to be learned.
He was serious. That's what I'm talking about. I don't do small talk, and I'm not getting on the precinct dating circuit.
Okay, Hot Pepper's psychiatrist 5 cents sign is down. But you get me worried, spending more time talking to gangers than to regular folks.
Radio was calling for units to clear to answer a robbery in progress the next beat over. They simultaneously slammed their cars in gear. Salt switched on her blue lights and watched as the strobe found and washed over Stone. He hadn't gone far, but stood leaning against the wall in the growing shadows of the 1400 building. He was watching Mann, who was laughing with someone on a stoop 2 rows down. She reached to switch off the cruiser's AC, both to give the car more power, and as a reaction to the sudden sensation of a chill from cold sweat underneath her vest. Chapter 10. The Impression. A disturbance call brought Salt to the Thurkill Avenue buildings. Night clouds were boiling high, backlit by lightning, like some old black-and-white horror movie, rain holding off until the climax. Young teenage boys were swinging fists, sticks, rocks, whatever they could pick up or put their hands on to bash one another. It would only be months before some of them would have guns instead of having to make do. 3306 to radio. I've got a fight in progress. Start me another unit. She waded in to stop the beatings. Her hands, strong from holding sheep shears, hoof clippers, and feed bags, firmly grasped young muscles, slippery with sweat and dirt, inserting her body as a barrier between the determined combatants, their grunts and growls like those of deep-throated infants. Stone was on the steps of a nearby apartment, his red-brown face gleeful, the rest of his tall, thin body invisible, out of the light of the porch bulb above him.
Tom-Tom, get him, he yelled over and over.
The blue lights of Pepper's cruiser added to the flashes from the sky as he pulled up to the brawl.
Which ones? He shouted.
She had two on the ground, one of her boots between each set of legs.
All.
Her breath short with the fight. He was already cuffing two together with his hand on a third. The boys, shirtless, their pants pulled or torn, still strained to get at one another. The ratcheting of the steel cuffs around slender wrists was accompanied by wincing as the metal restraints pinched skin against bone. Separation led to silence once the boys were herded into the car cages. Stone had disappeared.
I thought I saw the vulture, Pepper said, referring to Stone.
He was here. They were writing out the detention forms on the trunk of Pepper's car. A distant roll of thunder brought more surety of a storm.
That guy bothers me. He always seems to be around on your calls. Where does he stay?
Pepper asked, pulling out another form from his clipboard. I don't know. With anyone he can. Man takes care of him. I lost track of whatever family he had about 8 or 9 years ago. I'm not sure he ever had much of a family. Salt looked toward Shaw Street, a street on a steep hill in the project. A flash behind the clouds of the Shaw buildings lent them starkness. Her first memory of Stone, her first Christmas in the homes. Little kids on their new bicycles and tricycles. As much to cheer herself as anything, she had started singing into the car's outside mic, "Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus." The children would laugh, or hide shy smiles behind their hands. She had just turned the corner onto the top of Shaw. Two children were sailing down the hill on new big-wheel bikes. She began to sing, then saw the boys sitting halfway down the hill on the gray stone wall that fronted the apartments. He was naked from the waist down, his skin the same color as the bricks of the homes. His hands were in his lap. In one hand, a thing that glinted. Her voice caught mid-note. The kids sat quiet, watching from the bottom of the hill as she drove and stopped the car beside the boy. His pants were around his ankles, his erect penis in one hand, a mirror held close to his erection in the other hand. By the time he looked up, she was out on him. His lowered pants would have kept him from running, but there was no evidence of panic in his demeanor. He ejaculated immediately, as if her arrival was just the stimulus he needed. He held the cum-covered mirror up to her. She jerked his arms behind his back to cuff him, and the mirror fell and shattered on the pavement. He wasn't wearing a jacket in the bright, cold day, just a dirty tan sweatshirt that looked like it wouldn't hold up to another wash. Wrists locked together, his already broad, bony shoulders jutted up and further gained the appearance of curved vulture's wings. She hoisted his pants and led him to the cruiser. As he climbed into the car cage, she checked the interior, as if for future intelligence, in his small eyes the shine of a feral thing. Her mind worked to accommodate the experience of him. She'd been a rookie, not naive, but a believer. Salvation was around the corner. But that day, something hard formed in her chest.
Curtis Stone.
He gave his name when she asked. That was the first and last time she could recall hearing his first name.
Where do you stay?
At 1248, he answered, around the corner, two buildings up, at my auntie's.
She took him there, looking for a guardian to accept custody so he wouldn't have to go to detention, not on Christmas Day. Most of the Holmes residents made some attempt at Christmas decorating. A string of lights around a window, a plastic Santa in the yard, foil paper covering a door. At Stone's auntie's place, there was nothing. Salt hit the auto lock and got out. In the back cage, Stone put his lips against the window and mouthed, "My auntie, ooh, I'm scared," as he peered from the smeared window of the locked car. Salt knocked and called out, but couldn't get anyone to the door. The television blared at maximum volume from inside the apartment. Her baton dented the metal door and finally got results. Two little kids in underpants and dirty shirts opened the door. Behind them, the apartment was dark, the only light coming from a flickering TV, colors bouncing off the dingy walls. She shepherded the children into the apartment. Immediately inside the doorway, to the right, was a small kitchen. There was no odor of roasting turkey, only an iron skillet emitting a rancid smell from a quarter inch of congealed grease. Heat turned too high amplified the smell. The refrigerator door hung half open, its interior light harsh among empty shelves. A roach or two dropped, while families of roaches skittered from the walls. Her eyes adjusted to the dim interior.
"Hello?" she yelled. "Anybody home? Police!"
Farther inside the hallway, the metallic odor of crack, old sweat, dirty feet, and wet diapers overrode the old grease smell from the kitchen. The short hall emptied into the living room, where a large screen TV with bad color glowed with ghosts and lines. A commercial heralded the superior qualities of beer in a pink can by featuring a blue basketball player driving a sleek purple car to a maroon ocean. In the rainbow light from the TV, two men, washed by blues, greens, then red and purple, slept sitting up on a ripped leather sofa. Across from them, a teenage girl in panties and a large T-shirt was sitting in a recliner not more than 2 feet away from the TV. Just to the right of the blaring set, mesmerized by the screen, barely glancing at Salt before turning back to the next commercial, a lavender-haired woman earnestly preaching the importance of wise investing in a mutual fund. Salt walked over and turned the volume down. "Where's your mother?" The girl stared at the TV.
"She dead."
The two little kids followed Salt's every move, standing beside her and staring up as if she were Santa Claus. "Whose kids are these?" said Salt, pointing at the silent toddlers.
"The girl, she mine. The boy, he my auntie's."
"Where is your auntie?"
"She upstairs."
The men hadn't stirred. With the sound down on the TV, the voices of other children could be heard coming from the second floor. Salt climbed the stairs to the first landing. The two toddlers from below were trying to follow her, so she had to take them by their damp, sticky little hands back down to their mother-slash-cousin. "Watch them," Salt told the TV girl, who reached for a pink plastic baby bottle lying on its side on the floor beside her chair. She gave it to one of the kids, and the other child immediately tried to grab it. "Is there another bottle?" asked Salt.
"I put enough in it for the two of them," she said,
turning the volume back up. The housing authority mandated smoke detector upstairs sounded. Neither the TV girl nor the men on the sofa stirred. Salt sprinted up the stairs and found a small stream of smoke in the hallway coming from under one of the closed bedroom doors. Kids were yipping and laughing from behind the smoking door. The door flew open, spilling five children sprinting for the stairs.
"Biggie did it! Biggie did it!"
they screamed. Inside the dim room, there were blotches of color all over the floor. Salt's first thought was that a Christmas toy had been left unassembled. Then she saw that broken crayons had been fed into a portable heater, which was dripping green and orange onto the worn rug. The crayon papers had produced smoke, but hardly any fire, which was now out. Other than the heater, there was little else in the room, except for some bare mattresses. She yanked the heater plug from the wall, then crossed over to the window to check on Stone below. She pulled back the dingy sheet that served as a curtain and found the window boarded up on the outside. Still hoping to find a real parent, Salt followed music. Oh, Holy Night, coming from behind the door to another bedroom. Again, there was no answer to her knock. She pushed on the door. It stuck at the top corner. She pushed harder, and the door gave way suddenly and slammed into the wall. A skinny man and an even skinnier woman, both naked, jumped up from a bare mattress. The woman grabbed at a tattered curtain to cover herself, then quickly turned around to determine how much of herself she was exposing to a window. The man, seemingly relieved to see only a police officer, slumped back down on the bed. The radio on the floor beside the bed now rattled out a tinny, "Here Comes Santa Claus." "Are you Curtis Stone's aunt?"
"What's that little bastard done now? No, I ain't accepting no custody. Take him to juvenile."
"Merry Christmas." Salt turned, slamming the door behind her, and walked back past the now smoke-cleared crayon room and down the stairs. The scene there was just as it had been. The men slept through the smoke. The kids were screaming. The teenage girl glared at the purple-screened TV. Christmas wasn't going to come to that apartment. The fire-starting kids who'd fled the upstairs were outside, dancing around the police car, making faces at the impervious Stone. He watched them and her without expression.
"What, my auntie busy?"
he'd said as she got behind the wheel. It wasn't really a question. He flashed her a wide-eyed parody of a smile in the rearview mirror. Salt struggled to keep her face neutral, while a trickle of fear prompted the beginnings of despair. She felt he'd somehow tricked her, taken something from her, let something loose or was holding a secret she should know. On that Christmas day, she delivered Curtis Stone to juvenile lockup. His bony, 12-year-old shoulders hunched against the cold as she walked him across the fenced, razor-wired enclosure of juvenile detention. Salt wrote the report, notified Child Services, and was reminded that it was not against the law for kids to have no gifts at Christmas, but she still thought it was a crime. That was the first holiday she had gone to buy toys in a convenience store. It was the first time she had gone to the city jail with takeout dinners. And the first time she became aware that her faith in the redemptive power of Christmas might be insufficient. 10 years. Now, as the first hard drops of rain fell, Pepper was saying,
"We need to get these guys transported."
Salt shook her head. "Right." Then she and Pepper, cars loaded, drove through the storm, out of the projects, headed once again for juvenile detention with angry, battered boys. Chapter 11. Dogs. They had only been one beat away, finishing another call, when radio gave out, "Person down, shots fired." Now, about 3 minutes later, Salt watched with a sense of the absurd, as Pepper, in front of her, almost ran over one of the bodies in the parking lot. He locked his brakes and slid on turned wheels, inches from the body of a young man. It was his beat. She would be second officer on this one. She stopped her car, blocking the entrance to the apartment parking lot on Cohen Street. The bodies of two other men lay farther into the lot. The dead men must not have been residents of the complex. No mothers or girlfriends wailing or trying in their grief to grab their bodies. Nothing. No one moved in the still, gun-smoke-filled air.
One beater, its motor running roughly, was stopped parallel with the building. Stopped not in one of the faded parking spaces, but across a couple of them. Three of the car doors open. The trash-strewn parking spaces, adjacent to the two-story brick apartments, were empty, except for a few rusted-out cars. A tattered baby bassinet with broken front legs lay crumpled against the nearest corner. Three poles, one in the middle of the lot, and one at each end, provided the only lighting. Beyond the broken asphalt surface, the dingy buildings were lost in darkness. She and Pepper got out in the otherwise quiet night, their flashlights flickering briefly over empty shadows.
God, I thought you were really going to mess up the scene. Running over one of the bodies? Not good form, Hot Pepper.
My lightning-quick reflexes, he said with a short grin, wiping the sweat out of his eyes.
They cleared the idling car for possible perps and began checking the victims for vital signs, four fingers pressed under a jaw, drawing zeros on all three, no pulse, no breathing. Each young male had been shot multiple times, and each had sustained at least one shot to the head. The bodies lay approximately 20 feet from one another, in an almost perfect triangle around a sunken place in the pavement. The blood from each victim was seeping in slow streams toward the low spot. Paramedics arrived, confirmed and pronounced the official deaths, flicking their cigarettes with relief. They drove away with empty buses. By the time the scene tape had been strung, homicide arrived, Gardner and Wills again, the same guys who had been on Chanel's murder. The homicide unit was street-named the Hat Squad. Some years ago, a dapper detective had started the fashion statement, and it had stuck, though Gardner was sans hat as usual. They both wore short sleeves, and Wills had on a red tie, dotted with what looked like little femur bones. Salt and Pepper began working with them, marking the crime scene, collecting evidence, and trying to find, in the half-abandoned building, someone brave enough to be a witness. Pepper was canvassing the apartments. Salt was helping Wills make the measurements, using one of the light poles in the lot for a reference point. Like shadows themselves, they all moved in and out of the light. She was holding the carpenter's tape while he wrote the numbers. Without looking up from his notes, he asked her,
"You got any dogs?"
She paused a second, uncertain she had heard him right.
"Dogs?"
"Yeah, you seem like a dog person."
He smiled and looked up at her. She remembered his solid body and steady eyes from Chanel's.
"How can you tell? I do have a dog."
"That's why they call us detectives. What kind?" "I've got two myself."
He moved to place the tape at the right toe of one of the victims. "He's a stray I found in the Holmes, but I've been training him for 3 years, and he's working really well." She called out the distance from the toe to the pole. 8 feet, 3/4 of an inch.
"Either you're lucky or a good trainer. Strays can be iffy. How old was he when you found him?"
"I think he was still pretty young. I know what you mean about strays, especially from the Holmes. Some have been too abused to rehabilitate."
He moved the tape to the nose of the body.
"How long are you gonna stay uniform? Why don't you put in for detective division?"
"I don't know. I've still got unfinished business on my beat."
She tightened her hold on the measuring tape.
"You got anything on the Chanel McLeod case?"
"Who?"
"The woman in the closet on Marcy Street."
11.5 feet, she read from the tape. "Nope, that's a complete whodunit, and we've caught 4 more, not including these 3 since then. Gardner did find out from somebody that the victim's boyfriend, what's his name?"
He jotted the numbers down on his pad.
"Daryl Mobley Sr."
"Yeah, some neighbors said he was living in one of the shelters downtown. They didn't know which one, and we haven't found him."
He followed the retracting tape, walking toward Salt. She looked up quickly.
"How long ago was that?"
"Huh? About a week ago. Why?"
Wills reached for the tape measure. Do you think he killed her?